Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of my shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. Well, today I'm interviewing Jennifer Ash Rudick, who directed Dinner en Blanc, a documentary told in French with English subtitles about the world's largest dinner party. And I believe I have her on the line. Let me see if I have Jennifer. Are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great. You are welcome. Well, tell me about what inspired you to get involved with this project, and did you know about Dinner en Blanc before doing this?
I did. I had heard about it about 15 years ago from someone in Paris, and I thought perhaps I didn't understand what they were saying, because this was before I really knew about flash mobs. And she was speaking in French, and we were walking across a bridge in Paris, the Pont Neuf, and she said that they had had a dinner on the bridge, and that, you know, a few thousand people had stormed the bridge and set up a picnic with tables and chairs, and the police had tried to get them off with pepper spray, but they gave up, and they stayed and had their picnic. And so I was trying to envision it, and I kept it in the back of my mind. And then, you know, 15 years later, I was doing a documentary with Al Maisels on New York fashion icon Iris Apfel. And while we were filming that, the Dîner en Blanc was in New York. And I thought, I wonder if that's the same dinner that I heard about so many years ago in Paris, because I was told somebody from Paris started it. So I tried to track down this man. And I was told he didn't talk to the press, and he didn't want anyone to know who he was. And I thought, I really have, and the dinner is not for, he doesn't make any money from the dinner. People offer to sponsor it all the time, and he won't take any money from anyone. And by now, the dinner in Paris, I heard, had grown to 15,000 people. And I thought, I've got to meet a man who has a dinner party every year for 15,000 people, for the fun of it, not for fame or fortune. So I tracked him down, and it just kind of became a challenge. It took me 6 months to track him down. He finally agreed to have lunch with me in Paris and hear what I had to say. And I got there, and he sent his neighbor. So it worked out, though. His neighbor and I got along, and then eventually I met Francois, and you know, we had the same idea, kind of, which was kind of no idea. I just wanted to capture the beauty of the dinner and kind of see what happened. And that's how he started the dinner. So it worked out.
Did you plan ahead? Did you know what you wanted to capture, or did that kind of come later after you filmed everything?
I knew, you know, it took me so long to get a hold of him that by then the dinner in Paris that year had happened. It's every June. So I kind of came to it in November, and that's when they start their meetings. And there's a secret committee of 10 who decide it's a pyramid system, and friends of friends are invited. So I had, at that point, you know, he promised that he would give me complete access. So at that point, what was happening were these meetings in Paris. So we filmed the meetings, and that it was actually an incredible starting point, because I got to hear how they were planning these meetings, and it occurred to me that, you know, I got to see the dinner unfold, really, and I didn't time it that way. It's just I started filming as soon as I got permission, but it really was kind of the starting point. So I did have an idea that I wanted to see the dinner unfold and not let the viewer know where it would be, so that the viewer could kind of come along. If you're participating in the dinner, you don't know where you're going. So your group leader, who may have 10 people in their group, they may have 500 people in their group, they tell you to meet at a particular place in Paris, and you just come with you two people with their picnic and their table and their chairs, and then you don't know where the dinner will be held until you actually arrive there, either by metro or bus, or you walk. But the host will have, the group leader will have found out about 2 days before, and then only the 10 people who really organize the entire thing, they decide a couple of months before. So I really wanted the viewer to experience that whole thing and not know where the dinner was until they arrived at the end of the movie. So that was the only idea I had. And then I got more interested in how people set this up. So we decided we would follow about four different teams cooking and shopping for the dinner, because it's very much about connecting while preparing the dinner as much as it is meeting at the dinner. People cook everything themselves. They make their own hats. And, you know, it's very locavore that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes a whole almost ritual getting ready for this thing.
It really does. And, you know, that's what I experienced then in filming it with, you know, following people along the day before and the day of the dinner. You know, it's just a natural momentum builds up as they get ready and they get closer to it, and the clock is really ticking down. And we saw some people who went for the first time, and they were kind of feeling their way out about, you know, what to cook and what to bring. And then we saw people who had done it year after year. And, you know, the son always cleans the table. One daughter always gets the flowers. And they kind of... you know, everybody kind of, you're right, it's kind of a ritual. And we followed one family who now the daughter, they're the second generation. Their father was one of the original organizers, and now one daughter works in New Delhi. The other daughter's going to school in Edinburgh, and the rest of the children live outside of Paris in a little town called Saint-Cloud. And so they all come together for this dinner every year as a family, and they all spend, you know, the day cooking, cleaning, choosing what they're going to wear. The girls help with one another's makeup and hair. And you know, it's really all about bonding over this dinner. It's really all about collaboration and bonding and friendship. And I just thought it was beautiful and cinematic. I didn't really understand how important it was in terms of non-commercialization and in terms of friendship and whatnot until I started filming it.
What was it like to actually being at the event? It just seems like such a magical experience.
Oh, it's incredible. Well, I knew where the dinner would be, but some of my family came over too, and my friends. And I didn't tell them where it would be. So I can't tell you what it's like to go to a place that's a complete surprise. But mm-hmm. once you get there, it's really everybody sets up, 15,000 people set up this dinner, which is seated, and they set it up in 15 minutes. So, you know, 5,000 tables in 15 minutes. Linens are put on the tables, and your group leader gives you a section. I won't tell you where this one is in case anyone wants to watch the movie, but you're given a section in front of this Parisian landmark.
Landmark.
And yeah, landmark. And you and then even once you get your section with, you know where your group of, say, 50 on your bus will sit, then your host, usually, or your leader, has told you where in that section to sit. And then Francois, who runs the whole thing, he really knows what section is where. And he'll come over and say, oh, you've got to move, 10 inches this way. We have two more tables coming. I mean, it's absolutely magical to see that kind of, you know, that cooperation and collaboration. And then in 15 minutes, there are tables set for thousands of people in a straight line, like banquet. It turns into almost, it looks like one long table, and it, connected like a banquet table. And then where we were, there happened to be, you know, something magical happened right at that hour, right at that moment when everyone was set up. And again, I won't say, because that's in the movie and it relates to where the place was. And that was completely unexpected, because the people at the landmark did not know we were coming. And so they came out and did something for the dinner. And then what I must say did not happen in the New York dinner, but happened in the Paris dinner, is there's a hush that comes over the place when thousands of people are eating in this open-air space in Paris, and you hear the din of conversation and the clinking of glasses, and that's really magical. And that started in New York, but then they played music. So then we had music all through dinner, which was fine, too. It's another kind of fun. But I have to say, being in Paris in the middle of an open-air spot and hearing thousands of people in a hushed conversation was really special. And then at a certain hour, they play music, and everybody dances. And, during dinner, you don't necessarily know your neighbor, so people are sharing food and wine and, it really is special.
Mhm. And did you meet some new friends doing this? I would think
I'm
you
sorry,
would.
Did you say, I'm sorry,
did
what
you
did
you
say?
Friends? Did you make new
yes,
friends?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, my son and a friend of his were there, and they ended up going out for the night in Paris with some new friends.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then our friends who we made, we had prepared the dinner with, and we're going back next year because, it's a very special connection, and you do get to know people, when you're put in a unique situation with someone, you get to know them pretty quickly, and that's what happened. So we're going back this year. We made new friends. And I should also say, when you're going in Paris, people don't just, it's not like, I don't know if you're in New York, it's not like a lot of major American cities where you might hail a taxi or just hop in your car. In Paris, mm-hmm. people really do take the bus and the metro. So you're walking with your table and chairs, maybe, but when we first started walking to our first meeting point, we were, I think, three couples. And by now, it's been going on in Paris, this is coming up on the 25th year. So when people start to see people wandering around in all white, they realize it's the night of the dinner because it's always a certain night in June, but you don't really know what night that will be either. And mm-hmm. and they were screaming out their windows, where is it? Where is it going to be this year? And so a lot of Parisians are aware of it now. When they see people in white, they get pretty excited and they try and figure out where it will be, and they like to come, which is one of the reasons it's secret, but they just come and watch, and a lot of people who were not in white joined in the dancing and whatnot.
Did you get to eat some of the food? Because it looked really good.
Oh, the food's incredible. Yeah, in fact, I wasn't at this particular dinner, but a friend of mine said that once it was on the Place des Invalides, and their group was one of the first to arrive, but only by moments because everybody truly gets there at 9:30. So, they arrived maybe 2 minutes before 9:30, and there were people playing soccer on the lawn. And here they come in a group of 50 with their white tables and dressed in white and everything. And the people playing soccer, this was early on before a lot of people knew what it was, kind of looked at them like, you're in the middle of our soccer game. And my friend said, well, we really have to set up right here. And they said, why don't you set up 10 yards the other way? We're playing soccer here. And they said, no, we really have to set up here. You'll understand in a few moments. And what they did, you always bring extra glasses. They opened their champagne, had their extra glasses, offered it to the soccer players who kind of looked at them, like, what are you talking about? And all of a sudden, they said, the soccer players turned around, and here were thousands of people coming their way. And they said, okay, and they took the glasses and took their ball and left. So, it's a lot of fun.
Did you have one camera crew at the event, or did you have several?
I had, at the event, I had three camera crews at one location, but each crew was just really two guys. It was one crew had sound, and we kind of texted back and forth because we were trying to do some interviews during the dinner. And mm-hmm. the sound is kind of a mess, as you can imagine, in a situation like that. You're outside and you have the wind, and it's nighttime and you have all the ambient sounds. And it just, we had to really work on the sound. It was very difficult afterwards. And you can't, we were trying to interview Francois and his son at the dinner, and you know, to ask them to step away from the dinner also is quite awkward. So, because, you know, it's really their night and you don't want to be too intrusive, but they want to help. So, so that was tricky. But, so I'd say we had three crews. One crew was a cameraman and a sound guy, and the other crews were two cameras who went off together. And then this particular year, there was another dinner at the same time. They just had so many people, and they wanted to try to accommodate everyone. And so there's another dinner at the same time at another location. And so I had two crews at that location because they told me that would only be 3,000 people. And two crews, you know, four guys, sometimes they split up, but they can cover a lot of territory if they keep moving. Mm-hmm. And I asked them to, they went to each place before, of course, the dinner got there and tried to capture the place before everyone arrived so then they could get people arriving. And then one crew arrived with Francois and another crew on another bus. So, you know, they worked really hard because I was trying to do this on a shoestring. And so that was a lot of cameramen for me that night. So they really worked hard. And that same group split up the day of and followed all different groups around getting ready. And we were trying to get different types of stories from different people getting ready for the dinner. I hesitate to even say this, but I was kind of thinking, because it's, you know, such a special movie, and I don't mean to compare my film to this, but in my mind I had the idea of Babette's Feast, where it's just as important as she goes around and makes this meal for everyone, and there's just, you know, just as much meaning in the preparation of the meal as there is in the sharing the meal. So we really wanted to get everybody preparing for the dinner.
Did the crew also come from America, or were they French?
No, they're French. We at first had an American crew come over, and it was really expensive to fly and to put them up and feed them and everything else. And you know, it was just, they didn't connect as well, honestly, with the subjects, and I'm already American, and my French is not so great, so it seemed like a better idea than to start over. So we did have to can that whole thing and start over with a French crew. And I was really lucky because I had been working with Al Maisels on this other documentary in tandem, and the guy who is one Al's favorite camera guy, his second camera, had worked with someone recently in, I think, Savannah on a film. And he's Parisian, so he said, you know, call Oog, and he's the nicest guy in the business. If he's available, he's also really good, and he shoots the way I shoot, then, and you can get him, you know, you're really lucky. And I just lucked out because he was available, and then he also helped me get all the other cameramen over there. And, you know, it's incredible. They all spoke perfect English, and they were all French. And and most of them had actually worked in America a lot. You know, these cameramen they travel all over, and they're young, and they go wherever the work is or wherever what interests them is. So a lot of them speak many languages.
Is it easier to make a film in Europe than it is in the States?
Can you say that again?
Is it easier to make a film in Europe than it is to make it in the United States?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I guess I was doing them I would say in this particular case, it was easier to make it in Europe and in France because in France, you know, you follow someone around and you go into a cafe and you're shooting them or you're shooting them, you know, when it's stores, they shop. And you walk up to the store owner with this permission slip and they're like, okay, and they sign it. And it's just incredible. And they're not litigious. They're not, you know, they kind of get the creative process. They think it's kind of fun. And they're not, this is what really struck me at every single shoot, is they are not self-conscious in front of the camera. And maybe I just got lucky with the people who I shot. But, you know, you don't have a lot of people. I think in one instance, someone waved to the camera. you just, people go about their business and they, and the subjects themselves just go about their business and pretend like the camera wasn't there. If you're in a store shopping, the store owner who's helping the woman shop for her white dress doesn't seem to care that you're there. In that way, it was such an easy process.
Yeah, I bet. That sounds a lot easier.
You know, that's
easier.
Hard. I mean, when you're doing a documentary, that counts for a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. People are happy to do it. They don't mind being shot. They're happy to sign a permission form. I mean, what more could you ask for?
Yeah. What about permitting? Did you have to get permits for this?
Funding, did you say?
Permitting.
Did you have to get any permits for doing this? Oh, permit. Oh, you know, how it works is you, where the Dîner en Blanc was actually held, if it's a public gathering and you post a certain amount of signs on the, this is more about the people in the movie. For example, you know, at the dinner, you're shooting random people and interviewing them, and you're shooting big groups of people dancing, and you just couldn't possibly get permission from all of them.
Right.
But if you post, I can't remember the formula, but if you post a certain amount of signs saying that we are filming, and if you're in this area, you may be filmed, and, you know, therefore you just gave us permission by reading the sign. that's good enough. Unbelievably.
Okay.
And so we posted the signs before the dinner, and they were up there. And apparently the people who know about these things, attorneys, say that that's fine, that we're covered. And then, you know, you film it. You film your sign posted quickly at the beginning and at the end, so you just have some evidence that your sign was there. And so far, no complaints.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so, but permits to actually go and film in Paris? No, we did not have to get any permits. And again, it was, you know, no one ever came after us. I mean, we took Francois around to all of the major places that he has had the dinner, the Place des Invalides, the Grand Palais, you know, all these places, the in front of the Louvre and the front of the Pyramid and the Cour Carré de Louvre. And these are places where you would see an armed guard walking with a machine gun. And but, you know, you have two cameramen, you're very discreet, and you have Francois and his wife, and it all seemed to be okay. No one shut them down. And
great.
In the cafes, nobody seemed to mind. Again, at one point it was pouring rain. We had to go into a cafe to interview him. And the people in the cafes, you know, they move their chair over an inch because they don't want to be annoyed with your little, you know, sound you know, guy in their face, and they kind of look at you, and then they move over, and they forget you're there. That was really my experience the whole time.
Wow. What was the most challenging part of filming this?
I would say the language. I mean, this is the film I'm doing with Maisels is my first film, and so this is really the first film I've done on my own. And and not going to another country, not speaking the language very well, and not knowing what to expect, it was kind of hair raising at times, because I would forget I'm in charge, because on the Maisels project I'm not in charge, you know. And so it was a little stressful that way, but I would say it was definitely more fun than stressful. And and then I would say the translation was really hard. When you get home, like for the secret meetings, those are completely in French, and it would really not work.
Hello? Oh, I lost you for a second. Are you there? Oh, I think I lost Jennifer. Hopefully she's going to call me back. We're just talking about her film, Dîner en Blanc, but hopefully she will give me a ring back here. Let me see what happened. Okay. Call me back. Okay, well, we're right in the middle of talking about this wonderful, magical film that I suggest that everybody check out, Dîner en Blanc. But it was shown at the Palm Beach International Film Festival, and unfortunately I was unable to go to the screening, but I did see a screening of my own of the movie. But I thought, what a magical, wonderful film where these people, like you said, 15,000 people descend out of nowhere. But I'm talking to her right now, and I think I have her back. Let's see. Okay,
here I am.
Jennifer, are you back?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Okay.
Hi.
All right. We were right in the middle of talking. I don't know either. Oh, I was asking you what the most challenging part was, and you said the language barrier.
Yes, because when, for example, in the secret meetings, they're in the movie. They're not in too much, but it's all completely French. And so even while they were having the meetings, it was very, you know, when you have 10 people speaking quickly in French, it was very hard for me to follow. I could kind of get the gist of where they were thinking about having the dinner, but they were trying to think about two places, and they always have a plan B, and it was tricky, so I'd have to get it home and have it transcribed. And then once you have it transcribed in French, then you have to have it translated. And you know, that whole, it was just a complicated, it was more complicated than I wished it was, and I couldn't move forward with kind of what I was thinking for the story until I saw all that. So it was just an added complication and, of course, an added expense that I hadn't budgeted for. I knew I'd have some translations, but I didn't realize how expensive it would be. So I would say that was a big challenge.
Yeah. How long did it take to edit the film?
I had the best editor ever. I worked with the best people for, you know, the camera crew, the editor, the translators were amazing. But this editor was so wonderful, and it took about 2 months, I would say, 2.5 months. But that's because he worked on and off also as you know, he could, because I think what happens often, these editors get scheduled for big projects and more commercial projects. And he knew I wanted it to be finished by a certain time, but he kind of worked on it when he could. But what I did in that process was, you know, we never worked side by side, which I hear is unusual. What I did was they gave me the drive, you know, the hard drive from Paris, and then it had to be transcoded to high definition, more of an American drive. So we did that. And then I had this drive that I could put into my Mac, and I could watch all 80, I had like 80 to 90 hours of film. So I could watch all that footage. And I didn't really have the capacity right then to, I didn't know how to take clips off the footage. So what I did was I filmed the footage with my iPhone, and I made my own clips with my iPhone, and then I would email them to myself, and then I would take the clips and put them up on my computer and play with them on, you know, the big screen of the computer, putting like this clip first, this clip second, as, you know, you can imagine, and wrote down all the time codes, and then I emailed the clips in order to the editor.
Wow.
And then I gave him all the time codes also in case he wanted to work that way, and then I gave him my notes. And then, you know, I said, please, you know, you've done this many more times than I have, and I had seen his work, and, you know, I consider him like a major talent, a gifted editor. So I said, but if you look at this footage without all, would you do me a favor and look at a lot of the footage without looking at my clips first and see what strikes you? And he did that, and then I sent him my order of clips, and then we took it from there.
Wow.
And we were pretty much on the same page, and then he said, you know, well, this is an odd way to work, to say the least. I've never done this, but it did seem to work. You know, where there's a will, there's a way, and if you really, you know, it's amazing what you can do now with all these new gadgets.
Yeah, it must have been really hard to know what to include.
It was, and, you know, I guess it was, it's, you know, certain things really just pop out at you. I think you asked me about the challenges, and what I forgot to say also was that we had, as I said, four crews out the day of and the day before. And I would say a challenge was that I couldn't be with all the crews. In fact, I was really pretty much with one crew the whole time. Well, I visited them all, but I was mostly with one. And so I really had no idea what was happening until I saw the film. And so that was, maybe it worked out better because, I didn't have any baggage going into it. I saw it on film for the first time. And to see that kind of, there are things that just strike you that I think, if you and I watch the same footage, they probably, it's so obvious what is good and what resonates. So I think it was a lot to go through, but I think it was in the end, as you know, when you get to the last part of the footage, you're picking a lot less. At first, you're thinking, that's good, that's good, that's good, and you're picking so many different clips, or in my case, recording so many with my iPhone because everything looks good and you don't know what you'll have down the line. And then as you get down the line, you're like, okay, now I have like 1,000 good clips. I probably can be more choosy now, and then you start deleting them and starting over. Or that's how I did it.
The film was shown at the Palm Beach International Film Festival. Where is it going next?
That's a really good question. I entered it into, I entered it into small local festivals because I've never done this, and I know festivals are so incredibly competitive, and I didn't want to set myself up for a lot of disappointment, which I still may have, mind you, but I entered it into like the Maine Film Festival. I entered it into New York City Docs, which they don't they run in October, so I won't hear from them until I think I hear from them in September. Actually, I entered it into what's the document? One in California. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on this. Orange County, San Francisco Film Festival, I entered it into. So I have I started a Facebook page for it. So if anything comes in and it gets into some festivals, I'll list it on the Facebook page. And the Facebook page name is Dîner en Blanc, the world's largest dinner party. And then it says documentary.
Is there also a website for the film?
No, there's not a website. I'm going to restock the coffers and ask someone to help me build a website.
Yeah, okay.
You can get the trailer. You can literally Google Dîner en Blanc trailer, and it'll give you the Vimeo trailer.
Okay, I'm glad that you pronounced that properly.
It's not Dîner en Blanc,
it's Dîner en Blanc. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, people pronounce it all different ways. But, the film really lends itself to music because, it's a tour around Paris. I mean, even if you don't, it has subtitles, but, I mean, it's just a great tour of Paris. So the music was, I had a composer, and he was just so wonderful. I bought the first song, the last song because I just found too that we felt fit like no others. So we bought those, but then I think it's just kind of charming.
Mhm. Absolutely. Well, we're running out of time already, but I was hoping to get some time to talk about your other project about Iris Apfel, but we don't have time today. But hopefully, I can bring you back. When is that project going to be complete?
We're hoping that'll be finished in this coming fall. We're shooting for September,
okay.
October. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and hopefully that'll really, what we're dying to do with that is play the film. We want to do the festival circuit with that because it's just, they tell me it's a lot of fun when you get into these big festivals. And the first festival with the Dîner en Blanc was, I have to say, it's a lot of fun.
Well, hopefully, like I said, we'll bring you back and we can talk more about that. And I also wanted to talk more about you being a writer and an editor and all those things. So hopefully we can bring you back on board and talk some more.
Oh, that would be really nice. I really appreciate you having me today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that was a wonderful conversation with Jennifer. Glad she was able to call us back today and finish up that conversation. But I had so many other questions for her because she's also working on this other wonderful project, and I'll probably mispronounce this name, but Iris Apfel, who's a fashion icon. Kind of, you see her and you think, wow, she looks a little eccentric, but she's this fashion icon. You see her around Palm Beach all the time. But it's called Iris Apfel, New York Rare Bird of Fashion, and she's been working on that project. So, like I said, hopefully in the fall I'll bring her back and we could talk more about that film as well. In addition, she is a journalist, a writer, and an editor, and she's an author of a couple books. So hopefully we'll be able to talk more about that too. So you can always Google her and find out more about some of the stuff that she's up to. But definitely check out the Facebook page, Danae en Blanc, now that I can say it properly. Check out her Facebook page and find out more about these wonderful parties that have sprung up all around the world in over 19 countries. Different people have been inspired by these parties, and they've had them in New York, Singapore, all these different places. I have a whole list of all the places that they have been sprouting up in. So it's really like a flash mob. It's taken off, and it's really inspiring. Okay, guys, well, that was our show today. And next week I'm going to be interviewing the director of The Shift, so you definitely want to tune in for that as well. He's another director that had his film shown at the Palm Beach International Film Festival. And as you've seen the last couple weeks, I've been interviewing directors from the festival. And after The Shift, who knows? I'm not sure if I'm going to have another PBIFF director or who I'm going to have quite yet. I've got a couple people in the works, and I don't know exactly what day they are coming on board. Also, I wanted to let you know, on May 16th, for those that are here in Florida, at the Hollywood Arts and Culture Center at 6 p.m., Robert Odonto's film Rising Tide is going to be showing there. And I mentioned that on a different show, but I am going to try to break out and go to that as well. But he did a wonderful film called Pearls on the Ocean Floor about Iranian artists, women artists. And I interviewed him for that. So if you missed that show, you can go back and listen to the archive about it. And I did touch on Rising Tide in the interview as well. But he is having a showing of the film, like I said, in Hollywood. So check that out. In addition, right now, today, James Franco is in Miami for the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. He did a very interesting film called Interior Leather Bar. And it is pretty much what it sounds like. It's they're trying to avoid an X rating by cutting out a lot of the S&M scenes. So looks like a very interesting film, but that's shown at the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, which runs through May 5th. And he is getting an Latin American Alley Award right now, today, at 8:30 p.m. at the Colony Theater. So if you are listening to this live and you want to head down to Miami, I don't know the situation as far as getting tickets into that or what the availability is, but it is today, April 28th at 8:30 p.m. at the Colony Theater. James Franco will be there. To find out more about that festival, which, like I said, is running through May 5th and has a lot of great films showing, go to www.mglff.com. Okay? If you're a director out there and you're listening to this program at any time and you would like to come on board and be a part of the show, please email me. My email address is ravenprods, so it's ravenprods at yahoo.com, and I would be happy to look at what you have and more about your film and see if I can bring you online and talk to you and do an interview, okay? All right, guys, well, that wraps up the show today. I thank you for listening, as always, and please pass this show along to your friends. I want to get it out to as many people as possible. I do this program for your benefit, not really for mine, for your benefit, because I think it's important to showcase creative artists, creative filmmakers that are out there making a difference and doing these wonderful projects. And I also hope to educate filmmakers or actors or people that are in the industry that are listening to the program. I hope to kind of give them some insight into what other people have done to help them, you know, in benefiting their own career. So I hope that it works. I hope that that's working and it's helping everyone. And if it does, please pass it along to your friends because I want to get this out to as many people as possible. And you can also check out my Facebook page, guys, which is Indie Streak, just like this show. And please like the page. I will be putting up some additional stuff up there soon. So keep in touch on that site. And here at the radio show as well, you can see the upcoming shows. And like I said, I have a ton of archives you can go back and listen to at any time. Okay, well, I'll be back next Sunday at 1 o'clock. Please tune in there. Okay? All right. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.